Iran, Iraq, Syria, North Korea, China, and Japan. Just a few of the places where evolving politics means significant implications beyond their borders. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Day, we'll focus on places in the world we should be watching for changes in U.S. foreign policy as we move through 2014. Joining us this hour, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Lindsey Kahn, a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. We'll ask them to bring us up to date on U.S. foreign policy challenges around the globe and give their analysis. What are your geopolitical concerns for 2014? Join our discussion after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again, and we want to take today as an opportunity to look forward to 2014. With all things political that concern our foreign policy, and joining us to do that, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Jim, Happy New Year to you and welcome back.
Happy New Year to you, and thank you for inviting me back.
Also with us, a voice we haven't heard on our airwaves for many a day, Lindsey Kahn is with us. She is the Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow and working as an advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism on leave from the University of Northern Iowa. Professor Kahn, Lindsey, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks. It's great to be back.
Great to have you back and to ask you a little bit about your current duties and and be able to spit out that great title you have as well.
I know you had to take a big breath, huh?
I sure did. We wanted to this hour, Lindsey and Jim, just survey some of the areas in the country, in the world rather, that will be challenges to U.S. foreign policy. And we want to have our listeners join in the conversation. What are your geopolitical concerns for 2014? Where do you think U.S. foreign policy is on the mark, and where do you think it's off the mark? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. And we're also on Facebook, where you can leave us post a question or a comment or tweet us at IPR Talk. And let's start off with the most bizarre news on the international front. Why not? On Monday, as a birthday present, former basketball star Dennis Rodman helped put together a basketball game in North Korea for its leader, Kim Jong-un. And Rodman calls the dictator his friend. And he brought other U.S. basketball players to North Korea for this friendly game. As part of the event, Dennis Rodman also sang Happy Birthday in front of the packed stadium.
Happy birthday to you.
This was not the first trip by Dennis Rodman to North Korea. He was again criticized for being friendly with a dictatorship that is otherwise anything but friendly to the United States. In an interview on CNN, Rodman and others defended the trip, and with answers that were at times angry and incoherent, Rodman suggested he wants to spread goodwill through the love of basketball.
I'm going to tell you one thing. People around the world, I'm going to do one thing. Your guy behind the mic right now, we are the guys here doing one thing. We have to go back to America and take the abuse. Do you have to take the abuse? Well, we're going to take. Do you, sir? Let me know. Are you going to take that bitch? We're going to get it. But guess what I do?
And Rodman eventually said that these types of events could eventually, in his words, open the door with North Korea. Let me start with you, Jim. Perhaps not very significant, but certainly out there in our headlines today. What do you make of all this?
Well, it's really quite a bizarre kind of episode that we've seen. And, of course, as you mentioned, this is not the first time that Dennis Rodman has gone to North Korea. I can't imagine that, you know, very much will come out of this except for the North Koreans in terms of some publicity and kind of, you know, tweaking the Americans in some way. I think it's really negative, ultimately. And as that interviewer also asked him, as I understand, he asked about the fate of Kenneth Bai, I believe is the correct pronunciation of his name, who has been held prisoner since last November of 2012. And Rodman, of course, at least from what I understood, tended to side with the North Koreans in his response. So this, I think, you know, highlights obviously the issue of North Korea, but I don't think it moves the needle at all in terms of any kind of a positive resolution.
Lindsey Conn, what are the challenges that North Korea presents U.S. foreign policy currently?
Oh, I see. You give me the hard question.
You could talk about Dennis Rodman if you like to, as a preface.
Well, the challenge that North Korea presents is that the challenge that it has always presented is that we have no idea what's going on inside North Korea, and the recent behavior of Kim Jong-un makes that an even more difficult problem, because, you know, at least with Jang, his uncle, in place, we knew that Jang was very close to Beijing, that the Chinese had a lot of influence over him, that he had a lot of influence in North Korea. And, you know, there was some hope that that would lead to some kind of constructive development there. Now that Jang is gone, and gone in a very sort of unexpected way, and I'm not referring to the 120 dogs story.
That proved to be false, correct?
Yeah. It hasn't proven to be anything, but it's highly, highly unlikely. It was begun by a Chinese blogger who's attempting to impersonate a far more popular Chinese blogger, and it was just bizarre all around. But I mean unexpected in the sense that no one was expecting a purge like that. It raises a number of questions about whether Kim Jong-un is doing that because he's in a position of power or because he's in a position of weakness, and we just don't know.
Mm-hmm. What is your read on that execution, Jim McCormick? Why a very public execution of a former top official and his uncle?
I guess I really agree with much of the interpretation that it was an effort to consolidate his control. This was any opposition that might linger within the hierarchy of the military in particular should really get the message. So I think it really was an effort to consolidate his power. And as Lindsey suggested, maybe there was also a little pushback against Chinese influence here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
North Korea has announced this week the first parliamentary elections under the new leader, Kim Jong-un. Lindsey, how should we understand the purpose of elections in such a system?
Well, you have to understand that the vast majority of what the North Korean government does is aimed at a domestic audience, which domestic audience has been fed a great deal of misinformation about itself and about the rest of the world. They have been told that they live under a certain kind of regime, and parliamentary elections are part of maintaining that myth.
Mm-hmm. What is the real threat that North Korea poses to the United States, Lindsey?
Well, I wouldn't say that North Korea poses a direct threat to the United States in the sense that, they still can't reach any U.S. Territories with missiles or anything like that. The main threats that North Korea poses are to our close allies, South Korea and Japan. And that's our main concern. And, stability in the region more generally. We have a lot of interests in that region. We have a lot of trade with that region. We have defense treaties with neighbors in that region. The real danger that North Korea poses is destabilizing that region, which, of course, is an unstable region to begin with. China has a number of disputes with Japan and South Korea, and it's just a place where you do not want sparks flying.
Mm-hmm. Jim, tell us a little bit about South Korea's role in our disagreement with North Korea.
Well, South Korea, a decade ago or so, had the so-called Sunshine Policy, in which they tried to really engage the North as a way towards even moving towards eventual reunification. With the new administration in South Korea, they have really backed away from that, and in fact won the election on really opposition to that kind of sunshine policy. So they're much more cautious and alert. And of course, there have been incidents over the last really 3 years, I guess, going back to 2010, of sinking of a South Korean vessel and then attack upon a South Korean island. So, you know, there really is high tension. And then closing for a time the DMZ, or at least the cooperation they had in terms of industrial development, although that has been recently reopened. So there is this tension on the Korean Peninsula, and of course, the United States has a treaty commitment to the South Koreans, which over the last two decades has been reaffirmed by both the Clinton administration and then by the Bush administration as well.
Mm-hmm. As we go through these areas, these hotspots around the world, I want to end and before we move on by asking what you see in the cards for 2014 in each of the areas, and in can we say anything will happen or will be decided in 2014 in the North Korean situation, Lindsay?
Well, I don't think we can ever say this or that will be decided. I think what the U.S. needs to do is to try to get out in front of that situation, both in terms of their nuclear program and in terms of their relations with their neighbors. And I think the best way for us to do that is to engage with China in terms of relations with North Korea and also with South Korea in terms of, as Jim pointed out, South Korea's relationship with North Korea has gone steeply downhill in recent years, but the South Koreans still have a significant interest in maintaining some kind of relationship with North Korea. So I think, you know, we need to start coming up with a sort of proactive policy as to how to contain that particular issue.
If you just joined us, Lindsay Kahn is with us, Jim McCormick as well, international political experts on this Politics Wednesday here on River to River. You can join our conversation with your thoughts on geopolitical concerns for 2014, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or leave a post on our Facebook page. Well, let's stay in Asia if we could. And you mentioned China and Japan. That relationship has been in the headlines throughout 2013 and into this year. One of the foreign policy hotspots to watch, a group of disputed islands in this area claimed both by Japan and China. Jim, give us some background on this dispute over the group of islands. I understand they've been under Japanese control since the late 1800s. How is it now that China lays claim to them?
Well, the Chinese have had, concerns about their territoriality for some time. You know, and historically, you know, the Western powers, the colonial powers have, had tried to have a stake within China. And I think this is part of getting this territorial claim back. And it's not just with the Shikoku Islands or Diaoyu, I hope I'm pronouncing that with the Chinese name for them, that are at stake. There are also really other islands in the East China Sea, in the South China Sea, that China, as it becomes more assertive, as it has had a bit of a rise here in power, if you will, I think wants to make a reclaiming of them.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, what does this claim by China to these islands represent? Why does it matter?
Well, it matters primarily for two purposes, claiming territorial waters and then claiming the resources within the territorial waters. As Jim pointed out, too, there are a number of disputed island groups in the East China and South China Seas. And China has been a disputant for these islands for quite some time. It's just that now that they feel that their power is increasing, they feel like they can push a little bit more. Specifically with the Jiayu Senkaku Island group, there are four gas and oil fields located fairly near them. And if you look at sort of a map of that area, the territorial waters claimed by Japan include one or two of those fields, leaving the others in Chinese waters. But the territorial waters claimed by China based on their claim to own the Senkakus or the Jiayus, that would include all four of those oil and gas fields. So it is a resources issue. Mm-hmm. Much more than a defense issue. I should really quickly state, I forgot to at the beginning, I am here in my personal capacity and nothing I say represents the views of the Department of Defense or the U.S. government. Just have to put that up there.
Oh, all right. Thank you for throwing that in. Also, if you just join us, Lindsay Kahn is with us. She's on leave from the University of Northern Iowa and she's a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. And you're joining us from Washington?
Yes.
Also working as an advisor to the Deputy Assistant of Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. I want to talk about that a little bit later. But so we had this series of events that we covered in the news having to do with this relationship, these disputed islands. In November of last year, China setting up an air defense identification zone, including these islands, requiring all aircraft entering the zone to enter a flight plan, submit radio information, an assertion of sovereignty. We saw there the U.S. and allies deeply concerned, reacting strongly. The U.S. flying unarmed B-52 aircraft through
the
zone?
That's right. Yes, yeah.
And do you see this tension, this sort of cat and mouse game, if we can call it that? Certainly not a game, but continuing on into this year?
I do, because the air defense identification zone that the Chinese has actually overlaps with the one that the Japanese have. And so I think that is going to be a source of tension. I think the other principal reason that I would see it continuing is that you have a new Chinese president here, Xi Jinping. And my sense is, my read at least so far has been that he wants to really assert, and he's gotten a lot of pressure back at home, assert more nationalism here. Even over the flying of these unarmed B-52s, you know, did arouse some domestic response in China. So I think that there's a leadership kind of imperative, as well as this kind of territorial imperative. And I think these are likely to be a continued hotspot.
Mm-hmm. What do you see for 2014, Lindsey Conn, in our relations with these troubled areas in the Pacific?
Well, I completely agree with Jim. I think these kinds of disputes are going to continue. I don't see those going away, mainly for domestic political reasons in both China and Japan. You know, Jim pointed out the domestic politics in China. Japan is in a very similar position. The prime minister is supported mainly by nationalists, and they will not back down on any kind of dispute with China. So in terms of how the U.S. needs to deal with this, I mean, I would say we don't need to worry about large-scale military conflict between the two anytime soon. That would not be in the interests of either party to start something like that. But we could see low-level military conflict, and the U.S. will definitely need to be engaged in managing that. We probably want to help broker some kind of deal there to avoid large-scale military conflict sometime in the future when China feels that it has a better chance of winning. But brokering a deal in those areas is not easy.
In just a moment, we want to shift our focus to the Middle East, talk about Syria, Iraq, perhaps South Sudan, Iran, and so forth. But we're coming up on a break. It might be a good time, Lindsey Conn, for you to tell us about your new position, Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. What does that involve?
Well, the Council on Foreign Relations is a think tank based in New York with an office in Washington, D.C., and they publish the very popular and well-regarded journal Foreign Affairs. And this International Affairs Fellowship is an initiative that they have taken, it's been going on for decades, to sort of promote exchange between academia and the private sector and the public sector. So I, as an academic with this fellowship, go and work in a policy office for a year, and I'm supposed to become a better academic, and policy is supposed to benefit from my academic expertise. If you were a policy person and you got this fellowship, you'd get to go to a think tank or a university for a year and sort of step back from the urgency of everyday policy issues and think more strategically. So it's a great program that's designed to improve policymaking and also the teaching and research on political issues.
Mm-hmm.
I am working, as you mentioned, for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense on Special Operations and Combating Terrorism, which is under the OSD policy and Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict Assistant Secretaryship. And so what I'm doing here is working primarily on an issue called the Global Train and Equip Program, which is a U.S. initiative to train and equip partner nation military forces to do counterterrorism operations so that we don't have to do them. It's I think it's a great program, and it's probably a model for what a lot more of our foreign policy is going to look like as we draw down defense budgets.
Mm-hmm. And so this means training other countries to acquire, train these small elite groups. Is that the face of counterterrorism in the future mainly?
Well, I think it's certainly one of the main faces. 1206 and Section 1206 refers to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2006, which is where this authority was created. And we don't just train small elite groups. We'll train any Ministry of Defense forces that are engaged in counterterrorism activities and equip them. And, it's mostly designed to further U.S. objectives in terms of the terrorist threats that we consider the most pressing. These are all partner nations with whom we have good working relationships. It's an extremely successful program and very, very cost effective, which is one of the reasons why. And it's also what's called a dual key authority between defense and state. So the State Department is heavily involved. As we spend less and less money on direct action, we'll probably want to look at programs like this to expand.
At the start of 2014, what do we consider the top terrorist threats?
As usual, we consider any al-Qaeda-affiliated groups significant threats. So al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and what used to be al-Qaeda in Iraq and is now either al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria or al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Levant, ISIS or ISIL, both of which have, of course, been in the news recently because of conflict in Syria and Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And since 9/11... when terrorism entered our vocabulary in a big way, what would you say have people studying this? What have been the lessons learned about terrorism?
Oh my goodness, there have been a lot. One of the big lessons learned, I think, is that terrorist recruiting is a very complex process. It's not just aggrieved poor people. As we saw with the 9/11 bombers, but poverty and lack of opportunity certainly create large pools of terrorist recruits. So one of the things that we've learned is that kinetic action against terrorist groups, in other words, simply killing as many terrorists as possible, is a necessary part of counterterrorism, but by no means the biggest or most important part. There are a lot of other sort of law enforcement actions that need to be taken, and also development activity that will help a lot.
Mm-hmm. What are you finding most interesting in your new position? We have 30 seconds before a break, and we'll get back to other ways. But what are you finding to have the biggest appeal there for you?
Well, let me just say that the government is not a well-oiled machine, but it works surprisingly well for what it is.
Okay, we'll leave it at that and go to a break. Lindsay Kahn is with us. She's on leave from the University of Northern Iowa, currently Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow, also, as she mentioned, working as an advisor to the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. Glad to have her with us after a long absence, and we are always so glad to have Jim McCormick, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Iowa State University. When we go back, we'll look toward the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Southern Sudan, South Sudan, and find out, update, have our guests update us about the situations there, give us their analysis and their look forward to 2014. We're surveying U.S. foreign policy challenges around the globe this hour on this Politics Wednesday with Lindsay Kahn and Jim McCormick. Hope you'll stay with us. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we are back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The battle surrounding meat and livestock production ranks among the longest waged and hardest fought in American history. Tomorrow on this program, my guest is historian and author Maureen Ogle. Her new book is titled In Meat We Trust. And in that book, it's a fascinating read, by the way. It's a story of meat in this country from the colonial period. She'll explain how, when, why the American way of meat shifted from a source of pride to an axis of controversy. Tomorrow, an unexpected history of carnivore America on River to River. Politics Wednesday on tap for today with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Also, Lindsey Kahn with us, Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. And we're looking at 2014 to try to look at, get some analysis on the major foreign policy areas facing the United States. And when we left off, we were asking Lindsey to talk a little bit about her new position in part of her other position, which is working as an advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism in Washington. One follow-up before we get to some of these other hot spots in the country, Lindsey, the Sochi Olympics are coming up in with Russia hosting the Olympics next month. And we've seen some acts of terrorism carried out in the run-up to that. How confident is the U.S. that the Russians have all they need to counter any terrorism that may be attempted?
Well, I mean, I can't exactly comment on how confident we are, but I mean, as an individual person who thinks about terrorism, I can say that you know, the Russians are not afraid to crack down very hard when they have terrorist events, and so. And they have an enormous interest in making Sochi successful. So I think that, you know, they know that there's a threat. They have an enormous interest in suppressing that threat. I think that we can be fairly confident that they will do a pretty good job of that. Of course, terrorism is one of those things that you can never have 100% security from. So we all have to be aware of the fact that this is not Canada.
Okay. Jim McCormick, let's turn our eyes to the Middle East. Let's talk about Iraq, which has cost Americans about $1 trillion and more than 4,000 lives. It's growing increasingly unstable, we're seeing in our news. What's going on there?
Well, I think the part of the explanation is a Sunni-Shia rivalry here. The Sunnis seem to be rising up against Maliki, who's tilting and towards the Shia and dominating, dominating Iraq. There are also elements, has become clear, there are also Al-Qaeda elements arising again. And so we have, I wouldn't say yet civil war, and it'll be interesting to see if the Maliki government can, you know, maintain kind of control, but we certainly have unrest, and it gives pause after the long involvement of the United States, and as you mentioned, the loss of 4,000 lives.
Mm-hmm. Could we conceivably see a redeployment of U.S. troops if Iraq things in Iraq worsen?
I think it's highly unlikely. I think the percentage there is about absolutely zero that we would send any troops. We might do some special ops, it seems to me. We might send some advisors in to assist if the Iraqis would request it. But, you know, the Iraqis have to be concerned about the kind of backlash they get. And also, you know, given the movement that Iraq has had towards the Iranians, you know, that's yet another complication for the Iraqi government's asking the Americans back.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting. Go into that a little bit, Jim, because Iran in some of these conflicts concerning against Al-Qaeda, that the U.S. and Iran find themselves on the same side, don't they?
Well, they have, you know, going back even to 2001 and, you know, the help that that Iran gave the United States in terms of intelligence information with regard to Afghanistan here was sort of one element that maybe there could be a more pacific relationship between the United States and Iran. That obviously has eroded. But now there's all the kind of the speculation, but the blowback that you get on that, it seems to me, is from some American domestic groups and from Israel over getting too closely tied to the Iranians because and also to the Saudis. I mean, you know, because again of the religious differences between the Saudis and the Iraqi, at least the Shia dominated government here. So I think we have to be very, very careful of any kind of cooperation with the Iranians. If they want to provide information, if they want to provide their sort of good offices to try to calm things down, I think that might be possible. But we have to be very careful to not alienate further. I mean, the Israelis are not happy with the interim agreement that was struck with regard to Iran or the Saudis, which also is obviously a major ally.
Lindsey Conn, your comment on the U.S.-Iranian relationship in 2014 and in light of the new leader in Iran.
Right, yeah. Well, I think, you know, Rouhani has definitely made some significant steps toward the U.S., and I think the evidence that those steps are sincere is that he's getting an awful lot of blowback from his conservative, groups in Iran that are unhappy with the way that he's behaving. I think, you know, it's important to remember that although the U.S. and Iran have sort of looked at each other as enemies ever since the embassy takeover, we've been on the same side of several issues in the last decade or so. And in fact, at the beginning of the invasion of Afghanistan and at the beginning of the operations against Iraq, we were... We could have cooperated with Iran on those things. We chose not to. The Bush administration chose not to accept the cooperation that Iran offered on those things for many reasons. But we, you know, as many people have pointed out, we sort of did all of Iran's work for them. We removed the two closest Sunni rivals that they had, which were the Taliban on one side and Saddam Hussein on the other. So we did them a favor in that sense. There are a lot of things on which we have sort of aligned interests with Iran. I totally agree with Jim's assessment of being the need to be careful because of the insecurity that the Saudis feel about our relationship with Iran and any sort of warming in that relationship. But at the same time, the U.S. has its own interests, and we have an interest in working some things out with Iran. The situation in Iraq is very disturbing, but I agree with Jim again. This is not yet at civil war levels. You know, al-Maliki was unfortunately much more short-sighted than we expected him to be. We expected him to aim at sort of long-term stability for Iraq, and instead what he did was aim for sort of pleasing Shia allies, and he is really, really trying to solidify the Shiite vote for upcoming elections, and any threat that al-Qaeda presents is good for him in that sense. There are some Sunni tribal groups in the Anbar province that are fighting against al-Qaeda. The tribes are not happy with al-Qaeda. Most al-Qaeda members are not Iraqis, and so the Iraqi tribes are not happy with this sort of foreign presence and foreign influence. But yeah, it is a very disturbing situation, especially considering the sort of cross-border dynamic with Syria.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned earlier we've spent over $1 trillion in many years of war, 4,000 lives, American lives, cost us in that conflict. Doesn't that make us wonder, Lindsey Conn, what we have to show for those lives and the money spent there?
Well, that's always a horrible question and a very difficult question to ask because it requires you to talk about the counterfactual. What would we have if we hadn't done it? you know, I think it's very fair to say that that we probably shouldn't have done this. At least that's my opinion. And I think there are an awful lot of people who would agree with me on that. But it's also important to recognize that we did do it, and we have to deal with the world that we have now. And we also can't fall into the sunk costs fallacy, which I know it's awful to refer to you know, human lives as sunk costs. But we cannot look at this situation and say we lost 4,000 people there. We should probably try to lose some more in fixing it. We kind of have to deal with what we have and try to minimize costs at this point.
Lindsey Conn with us along with Jim McCormick. It's Politics Day here on River to River, having an international slant, a survey to look at U.S. foreign policy challenges now and into 2014. Let's move to Syria. Jim McCormick, the first consignment of Syrian chemical weapons material has left the country on a Danish ship, according to the latest news reports. A vessel left a Syrian port yesterday, escorted by Russian and Chinese warships, and these are removing some of the most dangerous chemicals, a first step of a UN-backed deal to eliminate Syria's chemical arsenal. Is all of this deal to remove Syria's chemical weapons arsenal, going according to plan? Everybody happy?
Well, it's a little bit behind schedule. I mean, it was supposed to be done by the end of the year, so I guess there is some, you know, some slippage here, and the final cleanup, if you will, is to be accomplished by next June. But I would say that this is some sort of progress here in terms of these chemical weapons. The larger issue, of course, is that the facts on the ground have really deteriorated, at least from American perspective here. And this deal, it seems to me, is almost going to ensure that Assad remains in power here. I mean, I think that's kind of the trade-off that the Americans have made to get rid of these chemical weapons. I mean, certainly the official policy is still that Assad should go. But I don't see this moving in that direction in 2014 here. And it goes back to this whole Iran connection that we talked about earlier with regard to Iraq. I mean, could Iran be helpful? I mean, they've talked about the Secretary of State talked about maybe inviting them as bystanders at a conference on Syria and so on. And there was reaction from the Iranians over that seeing that as a slight, that they had much more of a greater interest in this. I think all of that kind of back and forth maneuvering really indicates that that we're going to have to live with Assad in power.
Mm-hmm. Lindsey Kahn, concerning Syria, give us your perspective on how you see the status of the civil war at this time.
Well, so I agree with Jim's assessment there, and the chemical weapons deal was. It is not going on schedule. The schedule was unrealistic to begin with. The schedule was unrealistic due to domestic demands within the U.S. that this, be done to show that it was happening. The Russians have always protested this schedule. But, given the fact that we all knew it was unrealistic, the fact that it's happening at all is kind of nice. So, we should make sure that we keep pushing for it to keep going and not be too worried about it not happening exactly on schedule. As far as the situation on the ground. Yeah, the peace conference is scheduled for the end of this month, or actually, like in 2 weeks, it really should have happened last summer. It would have been much better had it happened last summer, because last summer we were all in a stalemate, which means that everybody would have had an incentive to bargain. Now we are not in that situation anymore. The Syrian opposition coalition is requiring preconditions for their attendance. They want an assurance that Assad will have no part in a transitional government. That's not going to happen, and the Syrian opposition coalition is in absolutely no position to be making demands like that. And if they don't show up, they're just shooting themselves in the foot, because they're losing right now.
And there's a lot of infighting we're seeing in our news from a report here. Rebel commanders in Syria issuing a 48-hour ultimatum to Al-Qaeda-affiliated mm-hmm. fighters, ordering them to surrender or face a massacre. So we have splintering of the opposition to Assad. What is, Lindsey Kahn, at stake for us in Syria?
Well, this is an extremely important region to the United States, not just for the oil, which is, not in Syria, but the region. But this region has a number of strategically important things going for it. Number one, it's got a lot of resources that we want. Number two, it's often a source for terrorism. Number three, it's sort of a crossroads for all kinds of trade, especially in terms of the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, et cetera, et cetera. These are extremely important. The Suez Canal. These are very, very important trade routes. So we want stability in this region. It just so happens that Syria was the perfect storm in terms of a proxy war for everybody, which is why we wanted so badly to stay out of it. Everyone in the region has interests in how Syria turns out, which means that anybody interfering will trigger other people interfering.
It sounds like this is something that will go on for many years, and a year from now we'll be talking about a slightly different situation or some variation of it.
Yeah, I mean, we would hope not, but probably, because this peace conference, I think Jim's right. We're going to have to live with Assad, because now I do believe that the Iranians, I think the Iranians could be helpful in this. They have an interest, you know, there are three possible outcomes here. Assad could stay. We could have some, you know, the rebels could manage to destroy everything and throw the country into complete chaos, or we could have some kind of middle road. I think the Iranians recognize that a middle road is better than chaos. But if they can keep Assad, they will. And right now, the fact that the rebels are in such disarray is making it look like that's what's going to be the outcome.
Could I just add a couple
final
things
word
here
on Syria, please?
I think, you know, Syria actually, if Assad stays in power, is a really a big victory for the Iranians. You know, and it further expands their kind of control over Mesopotamia, if you will, you know, with regard, because Iraq is going to be sympathetic to Iran. And this causes problems for the Saudis, it seems to me, and for Bahrain and so on, which is more Sunni dominated here. So I think that Iran comes out, you know, looking pretty good if Assad stays in power. I mean, I know that they obviously don't want insurrection and an unsettled and unstable environment, as Lindsay said. But I think overall they would rather, in my judgment, have Iran in place. I think also the other winner in this, if Assad stays, are the Russians. In terms of the advantage that they get, not only because they have access to a port there, but also in terms of the kind of diplomatic victory that they can claim.
Finally, this hour, we have a few minutes left. I'd like to ask you about John Kerry. He has been the U.S. Secretary of State for nearly a year. He took office, took that post in February of 2013, taking the reins from Hillary Clinton. I wonder, Lindsay Kahn, how would you evaluate his first year?
Well, I think he's been doing decently well. He has a very good working relationship with Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, so the two of them have been coordinating their strategies well, I think. Kerry has, you know, he's made a couple of missteps. He's said a couple of things that would probably not have been, you know, that haven't been super helpful. But he has been extremely active in trying to get things started. Unfortunately, he hasn't accomplished much. But as you said, he's been in office for only about a year. So let's give him some time.
Jim, your evaluation?
I see Kerry as very much of a risk taker in terms of American foreign policy. I mean, stepping into the Middle East discussions between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which we really haven't talked about, but are certainly on the agenda for 2014. I see that as being willing to take risks to try to put an imprint on policy. I think his efforts, even with regard to Syria, although, as Lindsay pointed out, he sort of got a little bit ahead of the administration in terms of what they wanted to do on Syria. But I see him as much more, in that sense, much more innovative and much more willing to see what American foreign policy can accomplish, particularly compared to Secretary Clinton, who did a very good job, but was also very cautious and sort of not out front on some issues.
Well, we do have a couple minutes, Jim. Do talk about what you see in 2014. And I want to ask Lindsay about this, too, in terms of the Israelis and Palestinians.
Well, I wish Secretary of State Kerry very well, but you know this is such a difficult conundrum to try to unravel in the Middle East. But he has had success in getting the parties to talk to one another. I mean, the issues remain in terms of the settlement, and it seems to me that's been complicated even more because of the Iranian situation that, you know, in the American agreement here. So I'd like to be optimistic, but I think that if Secretary of State Kerry can pull it off, that will be really, really a very, very successful element of his tenure. But I would be skeptical.
About a minute left, Lindsay Kahn, for your evaluation of the Mideast peace talks at this time.
I agree with Jim. I mean, I think if Kerry can pull off anything at all in terms of just getting both sides to agree to any kind of step forward, you know, we're not looking at getting a comprehensive Middle East peace in 2014, but it would be nice if we could agree on something. And, you know, Kerry has had some success. You know, on the one hand, the turmoil in the region is bad and creates all kinds of opportunities for disagreement. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes external turmoil can be a good thing. It can make people feel like they need to get some problems out of the way and off the table. So we'll just have to see how Kerry handles it. I think it's going to depend a lot on his initiatives and what he decides to do.
One thing, if I could add, you know, for the past 2 years, the administration has said they're going to pivot towards Asia. And, of course, the 2014, you know, 2013 was going to be that, 2014. I'm skeptical they can do that because the Middle East keeps getting in the way. You know, and we haven't mentioned much of Afghanistan, but, you know, there is really what's going to be the future of American presence in Afghanistan, and that's yet to be determined as well.
So, and we haven't mentioned Africa at all.
That's right.
we only had an hour, so we were glad to have the survey that we did with those omissions. Thank you for joining us, Lindsey Kahn, Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow, and Jim McCormick, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you for helping us survey the hotspots in foreign policy, some of them with the omissions that you had. Lindsey, good to hear your voice again.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be back.
Jim McCormick, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, help from Cooper Holmeyer. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.